Live from the Gulf Coast and Central Texas, you're listening to Free Drinks Next Week. Still the number one podcast at this address. You never had the time to frown, wearing a smile.
For your money tonight, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, helps facilitate how the U.S., Mexico, and Canada trade goods, and the three countries are currently renegotiating that agreement.
Yeah, but after the first round of meetings this month, the future of trade is unclear. As CronFirst Washington correspondent Anna Wernicke reports, the price of popular imports from Mexico, like beer and avocados, could skyrocket.
First and foremost, NAFTA is important for Texas.
Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd says 17% of beer consumed in the United States comes through his district.
Mexico is Texas's number one trading partner.
But he says if the U.S., Mexico, and Canada can't come to an agreement, NAFTA will be repealed. And prices of imports will skyrocket.
If we get this wrong, we can see an increase in the price of beer when we go out. I don't think anybody wants that.
The last round of NAFTA negotiations ended in December, but ended with no clear plan for the future. And Mexico has an upcoming election, which could make any previous negotiations void.
We want to get it modernized, but we can't throw it away.
Texas Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar says NAFTA eliminated tariffs, so certain goods coming into the U.S. are a lot less expensive. So if NAFTA is repealed, prices will go up.
It's avocado, it's Corona beer, it's other things that we buy from Mexico that are just going to go up, because then different tariffs are going to come into place. And when they go up, who pays for that? It's not the companies. They're going to pass it on to the consumers, you and I.
The next round of negotiations starts in January. That round will take place in Mexico. In Washington, I'm Anna Wernicke.
Oh, no. So what are you going to do about your avocados if they go up?
Cry. I love avocados. Especially since we're in Texas. I mean, come on. We got, like, every Mexican restaurant on every corner, everywhere.
So what is the threshold of a price of an avocado becoming too expensive for you to purchase it? Or what is the cost now for the average avocado?
I want to say it's, like, around $2 and maybe, like, 30 cents if you buy, like, a whole avocado, maybe?
Is that per pound or for the actual avocado?
Maybe each?
Okay.
It just depends on, you know, the season or whatever. But they're pretty, and then they go lower than that.
So you have to look up the price. Money.cnn.com indicates the average retail price of a Haas avocado, which must be a type. I don't know the details of it in that sense. Is $1.58, which is actually up 43 cents or nearly 40% just this year of 2017.
Totally
organic varieties now sell for $2.99 an avocado, a $1.33 hike from their previous price, or roughly 80%. The surge charging is to be expected, according to the packer. So this is a known thing that avocados have already been high. I'm not sure, has this always been related to California, or what are the other factors that led to the increase of avocado pricing? And so I know you indicate as a consumer of avocados and an aficionado of it, I'm not sure, has the amount of taco places or restaurants that serve Tex-Mex or Mexican food increase that much nationwide, or did people prior to this year not eat avocados outside of a certain territory?
I would go with the second. I don't know. I feel like everything that I've looked up as far as recipes, I think now there's like an increase in avocado, you know, with your plate, or even in restaurants that aren't even, you know, Mexican related. I feel like they're like, oh, here's a side of avocado Or maybe that's just me. I don't know. But then again, they say it's healthy. It's a healthy fat to have avocados.
So that has to be the difference of it. This also reminds me of, I can't remember which economist wrote an article this year, but it was indicating that the reason why millennials are so poor isn't because of increased debt or the cost of college or the price of living, but because they eat too much avocado toast. As a millennial, is any debt that you've incurred over the last 20 years a result of avocado toast?
No, unfortunately, I have never had avocado toast, but I probably will say that it probably has to do with all those health articles. Because I've read that, you know, put some slices of avocado on your bread and, you know, it's that butter substitution or whatever. And I'm like, whatever.
Then maybe you're not really a millennial. You're a zillennial? Or a, how would you pronounce the X in front of lineal? Like Xerxes. I'm not sure if that's the correct way of enunciation for it.
Yeah. No. I don't know. But I just like avocados in my salad. Just cut it up. It's good.
Well, and Christopher Jr., of course, loves avocados.
He does.
He likes avocados, artichoke hearts, all the stuff that you ate during your pregnancy, with the exception of fish, which I think just him living on the Gulf Coast has made fish a part of his diet, even though
maybe
you avoided it for those 9 months.
It could be in the genes.
It probably is in the genes. Who doesn't love fish? Well, welcome to Free Drinks Next Week, the number one wine podcast at this address. FDNW brings you weekly conversations about something different over a bottle of something different. Join us each week as we discover new wine, beer, liquor, stories, and what make us tick. One part alcohol, two part stories that are shaken, stirred, and some entertainmentology. You can find Free Drinks Next Week on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Facebook, and our website to be named later. Give us a thumbs up on Stitcher Radio, like us on Facebook, and leave a review on our iTunes page. I'd personally like to welcome our co-host, my wife, Cassie. This is a special New Year's Eve episode focusing on the Houston market. The next episode will feature the rest of FDNW, hopefully to be recorded Monday night, as some of the hosts are on the road, are packing to get on the road to go back home this tomorrow. So, to start the show off traditionally, have you drank anything interesting this week? I know you've been traveling a while, having vacations. What have you drank, and what are you drinking tonight?
So, what did I have yesterday? I went to a place called Gringo's. It is a Mexican restaurant. And it was like a... It was a margarita, but it was like a whiskey?
No.
No.
I think it was a tequila aged similar to a whiskey, because it was aged in a whiskey barrel. So it had some of those. And we're back after a break from our guest fifth host every other week, Christopher Jr. But you were describing prior to Nature's Calling what you were drinking at Gringo's, which was a whiskey style of tequila put in a margarita?
Margarita.
Okay.
It was really good. So they asked me whether I wanted salt or sugar on the rim. And I know sugar's like this new thing for millennials or something. And at first I was like, maybe I should just do salt. But then I was like, well, does it taste good? And she's like, well, it tastes better if you do the sugar. I said, okay. And I tried it, and it did. It tastes good with that, but I still don't understand the whole sugar with just plain margarita. It's just odd. I don't know. I don't, but the drink that I had was really, really good. So I don't know if it was like a seasonal thing there, but.
But you make a point, because we've always taken shots of tequila utilizing salt, lime, and tequila.
Correct.
It's very rare that the shots are done another way with the sugar. And so maybe, and to think of having a sugar-filled tequila drink and having the rim with salt was always a weird concept to begin with. So maybe sugar is the natural connection that we should have made in the past for tequila consumption.
I don't know. Either that, or I was just thinking that millennials like candy and they just wanted more sugar.
Millennials are just toddlers, all grown up. Is that what you just said?
No, I didn't. Oh, man.
And what are you drinking tonight?
Gruyere.
And so that is what we're drinking, is the Gruyere Brut American Sparkling Wine. They're based out of New Mexico. This was probably actually the first wine I fell in love with. And most people, I don't think, say that with champagne as being their first introduction to wine. I started with sparkling and champagne. I moved to Chardonnay, didn't like it very much. And then I tried Pinot and other stuff that is blended in it. But Gruyere was probably my favorite American sparkling wine. And it's always go New Mexico tourism. If, as long as this is part of the route that you include, make sure it includes Gruyere. I think they have something like 18 different styles of varieties of Gruyere. So from...
I actually like this one.
Oh, it's a great one. And this is just the Brut, but you can get extra dry if you need a little more sweetness, dry if you need more sweetness. And then you can get rosé. They were one of the first I remember really selling rosé on a regular basis.
This one's not dry, right? Is that the way you...
No, Brut is drier than dry.
Is drier than dry?
Yes.
That's weird. I don't feel like it's dry to me. Maybe that's just me, but...
No, it does have nice notes, but yeah, Brut extra dry is always sweeter than Brut.
Huh.
And then dry is sweeter than extra dry. It sounds antithetical, but yeah. it's just how it works.
Okay. yeah, I wasn't really a champagne drinker, but I think I started just like any other wine lover. I started with Moscato in the beginning, and then I just kind of gradually graduated. But then it kind of helped because you had the Jeb. So I went through the right course.
I don't think there's really a right course in starting with wine. You really just go with wherever your taste buds take you.
Yeah, I mean.
Because I feel like everybody has shame, but the sweet wine section at every wine place is larger than the Merlot section.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like people who say they don't eat McDonald's. Obviously someone is. So all the people, I don't drink sweet wine. Ah, gross. Obviously someone's drinking it.
Yeah.
Because that's what's selling the most. And then you know that you're really hooked once you start buying the 5-liter box wine of your favorite one. But even that used to be because they had that Zinfandel, which I'm not even sure if they make anymore. I think it's like a Chablis that they have now. But yeah, I'm drinking that. And then this week for Christmas, Cassie did buy me the Nikki Coffee grain whiskey. I had the Nikki Coffee malt whiskey and meant to buy the grain. As good as the malt is, not a big fan of scotch or scotch style whiskey. I much prefer a bourbon style. So that grain whiskey, you still taste the Japanese just in how clean it is and almost uncut. But it's delicious, and it's probably my second favorite whiskey that I own. Or, yeah, after Eagle Rare, Nikki Coffee Grain comes in there, and I'm proud to drink a Japanese whiskey.
Yay!
But I'm sure we'll drink more. Champagne will definitely be a part of the New Year's festivities.
Yes.
Champagne and orange juice or whatever other mixer is the course for the new year. I do encourage everybody to remember, as tomorrow's Sunday, New Year's Eve, liquor stores are closed.
Yes.
And alcohol is not sold till midday at 12 if you're in Texas. So please be aware of that. Don't want you to be alarmed. It will happen. But yeah, so that's a summary of what I drank this week, and I hope you're drinking well too, and feel free to write in our call.
Yes.
Call about it. And so this week we have a first listener question. In college, I used to buy one expensive handle or expensive to me and my friends, example Jim Beam or Jack, a handle of whiskey and refill it with far inferior alcohol throughout the year. What prevents bars from doing the same thing and selling well whiskey when I order a shelf whiskey, top shelf, middle shelf, or low shelf? Has that ever been a concern of yours, of going to a bar and thinking you're ordering Bacardi, but you're getting whatever, like, Flamingo rum that's in the well area where it's easy to pick?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know why I would think that it's, like, some sort of alcohol violation. Or at least a restaurant one, right? Because don't they have to, like, make sure their sales kind of are parallel to what they're selling? I mean, as far as alcohol, right? No?
Well, you're absolutely correct on that one. Especially Texas being a three-tier system, what that means is a distillery or brewery can't sell directly to restaurants without certain exceptions, that they sell less than a certain amount a year. The way that TABC has it, they encourage you to go through a distributor, and the distributor to sell to the store. One, they figure that will limit kickbacks and people paying to get placements. Mm-hmm. And also they figure they could track it better. So, okay. As you indicate, if you've ever been in a Texas restaurant or a Texas bar, you see all of them have a stamp on it. And it's almost like a postal stamp, but a lot smaller. And when they finish each bottle, they scrape the stamp off and they throw the bottle away. But the stamp tells them what's in that bottle, when was it ordered, and how much is ordered for. The TABC does have rules against what's called refilling that prevents that from occurring. That if a restaurant does, it does happen every year, and there's many reported instances of it. Is everything okay? So the TABC does have rules against this and what's called refilling. In the state of Texas, in 2017, 88 establishments were reported for refilling bottles. That means either a customer report or TABC came in to do it. Wow. And saw the paperwork and were able to figure it out in the measurement.
I feel like there would be more.
No, I absolutely thought it would be more. And ironically, there's no reports from West Texas outside of one in El Paso. So it's either the TABC in West Texas is just a lot more stringent, or the bar owners in West Texas are just deemed more trustworthy with the alcohol that they're selling. That being said, out of the 88 reports, there are only 18 that were given a citation for refilling, where TABC could actually prove it out of that 18. So it's probably a really hard threshold, because if somebody's reported, they probably told the restaurant, I think this is BS, this is definitely not Grey Goose, this is some well Svedka or some well whatever Russian name on the bottle, and it's not what I wanted. And that restaurant continued to refill the bottle when TABC came in and was able to test it, or TABC happened to be there that second and saw them doing it. So it's a really hard threshold, because how can you really prove it's not that flavor unless you send it back to the creator of it to run their own tests. And then also, out of the 18 tickets, most of them were attached to people selling to minors. So it indicates that if you're a bar or establishment that likely has problems with licensing or selling to minors, that you could be brought in with all of this. and that could be a concern. So they're just, I'm not sure if that's a causation or correlation, but it's a really small amount of places that do it. So I wouldn't be alarmed overall if it happens. But if it does, you can go on TABC, you can report it anonymously, they'll follow up with it, and you can check in just by seeing the ID that they gave the report to. So, well, thank you. And if you have any more questions, please email us at sellerreserve@gmail.com. All right. So, an article specifically, I wanted to kind of go back to wine and what we were discussing earlier with champagne. There is a new law in terms of our, not a new law. What I've always heard with champagne is that you're supposed to drink it with the flute. On that, when you drink it in the flute, you're supposed to hold your fingers on the stem and not the glass, as to not corrupt the viewing pleasure, so you can people watch through the bowl of the wine glass.
I just like
and
the
so
bubbles.
You can also see all the bubbles in it.
Yeah.
And so how's your champagne tasting in your flute right now?
Champagne? It tastes like champagne.
And looking like a man. Well, here's an article from the Miami Herald. Miss Connie Ogle, she indicates that why you actually shouldn't be drinking champagne from a flute. Champagne's never a bad idea, and I agree with her sentiments already. So I feel like we connect on some type of sister from another mother relationship. Just that there's never a bad way. What do they say? Real pain for your fake friends and champagne for your real friends. I know I butchered that. So go ahead and tell me I tank it and send me in what the correct take is for that. But it's perfect for celebrating all joyous things and even sad things. Bubbles could uplift and they could support you. Does the shape of the glass from which you drink really matter? How could it? I've been perfectly content drinking wine out of jelly jars, coffee mugs, sippy cups, flasks, straight from the bottle, my cupped hands, an old shoe. And I would like to add a personal one. I do remember utilizing people's cooking pots when they ran out of cups at keg parties to drink out of. I have no problem picking up somebody's cooking pot, especially like their little tea one that might be like 10 or 12 ounces of water could fit in there. It's just the right amount. And such a huge handle, you're not really going to drop it. But the old shoe, that's not a real one. But Patrick Alexander, author of The Book Lover's Guide to Wine and host of Books and Books, Wine Appreciation Court, says the glass you use doesn't make much difference. The most important thing is the bowl should be narrow at the top to focus and concentrate the aromas. Personally, I like a big glass with a big stem, and it should be plain and clear, not colored or engraved or metal or all those ones that you see at Remembered Times or Remembered Things. What's the one with the engraved shop in the mall? What is it called?
Things to Remember.
Things to Remember. That's two tanks in a segment. Also, the Wine Spectator editor at large, Harvey Steinem, writes, a lot of us realized a long time ago that a really good fizz tastes just fine in a regular wine glass, maybe be better. Which brings us to Maximilian Riedel, 11th generation CEO and president of Riedel, a company that sells high-end glassware that I am far too clumsy to own. He is deeply committed to the idea that glass helps make wine. Since his family established the business in 1756, he has millions of good reasons to support the idea. Here's the thing, he's right. Riedel got his start assessing champagne when he was 18. Bubbly remains a passion to him. My first job was to work at a champagne house. He says when they gave us the tour of the wine cellar, I realized that wine professionals, the journalists who sell the wine, they don't use a flute to analyze the quality of champagne. The flute was a symbol from the past, something that they used in front of customers. What they used were glasses that resembled traditional white wine glasses for its new Fatto Amano line, Riddell worked with wine industry experts to help create a shape more in line with what wine professionals were using. Because we were skeptical, we tried it. Champagne glasses should have tiny imperfections and scratches in the glass to enhance the bubbles. And right now, we have it poured in both. One in a white wine style glass and one in the flute. Technically, both white wines. But for this case, you know what I mean. As you can see, the one with the flute still has more bubbles coming out of it and bubbles residing on the surface of the glass, mm-hmm. but especially the bottom of them. That's because of the tiny imperfections. But I guess let's do a smell taste of both of them, or a smell, and see if you could smell differently.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah. Can you?
I really can't smell the difference, but you are?
Yeah, or maybe because I have less. I don't know. I feel like the white wine glass, I can smell it better.
Okay.
And I think it's just the, you know, the aroma swirling in there.
See.
But the flute, I would think it would be more concentrated, but...
See, the flute, I'm getting more of a concentration, but the white wine glass, I'm getting more complexity from the smell, even though it's not as concentrated. But you're not smelling that when you're doing the
well,
both
I
of them?
Well, because I have a lot less in mine. But, and it could be that. But, yeah, no, I do, when you say complexity, yes, in the white wine glass, you know, I don't know why it makes me think of the sea or something. airy, you know, if there was a scent for bubbles, yes.
Okay. And I will say, I think it tastes better out of the white wine glass, but I'm not sure if that's just a sampling error as now we're reading the article about it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to think that one of the largest wine glass makers, or most prestigious wine glass maker that's widely known, is even changing their approach to it. Because we have two Riddell flutes because people knew that we were such big champagne fans. But maybe we need to get more white wine glasses.
Yeah. And just tasting them, too. Yeah. So I know I have a lot less in my champagne flute, but yeah, it's more concentrated in there. And then within the white wine glass, you know, I taste extra stuff. Obviously, I don't have the verbiage right now that's coming to me, but it does taste differently. So I would strongly recommend if you have that champagne, I mean, try it and see if you can tell a difference. And I know I'm drinking the same thing. It's like, I know I'm drinking the same thing, but it really amazes me that two different glasses give different tastes.
Okay. Well, speaking of different smells and scents, would you use a whiskey scented deodorant?
I would try it. I mean, come on, it's alcohol, right? You get that funky smell off.
I'll admit I've probably done worse with utilizing, I guess, that hand disinfectant. If you're like, ah, stinky pits, rub it under there. At least give you like 30 more minutes in the summer. Well, this article is published by Pop Sugar Beauty. Whiskey-scented deodorant exists, and it might just cure stinky pits. The article is written as
written
a sweat...
by a woman?
Yes, it's written by a woman.
Oh.
As a sweaty lady, I'm often commiserate with other musky women on how the heck to make pits smell less. A common cliche in such circles are the complaint of having tried everything to minimal results. But maybe you haven't tried it all. For instance, have you ever rubbed whiskey in your pits? One couple in, where else, Colorado, are trying to get women started in rubbing alcohol-based pit liquor under their arms. According to the founders, Eric and Jason Futch, it might be another word, but it actually works. The Futches have taken the Kickstarter to ask us all to back what they call an organic, crazy effective deodorant made from whiskey, vodka, and other entirely edible and entirely body-friendly ingredients. While the spray deodorant may be made of edible components, as spoilers, it will not get you drunk. Much like hand sanitizer, which also has an alcohol base, pit liquor supposedly kills bacteria and keeps your pits neutral or natural, which leads to less underarm odor in the midterm. This boozy antiperspirant comes in three fragrances: whiskey lavender, whiskey vanilla, and whiskey black pepper, but it won't make you reek of a college party. The Futches claim that the rigorous testing went into this product. Tesser says that the smell kills, or the spray smells strong after the first spritz, but quickly becomes undetectable. According to Kickstarter, no one complained about the smell, and although it's made from actual booze, it actually has a pretty unlikely backstory. So, are you willing to put a $12 Kickstarter for a 3.4-ounce spray bottle meant to last you 3 months?
I would try it. I would definitely try it just to see. I know a lot of deodorants, or a lot of people now, are trying to find other ways to kill the stink without using deodorants. So I would try it, just to be like, does this work? And then obviously I have you to kind of tell me.
Babe, you smell like a distillery.
And the only thing that I can, you know, that I am leery about is, you know, I do have a full-time job. I can't, if it does have a powerful scent, or maybe my body will give, you know, because just like any spray, whether it's cologne or perfume, based on everybody's chemical body odor, it could cause different smells. So I just don't want to go to work and people are like, so somebody had fun last night, did you even, you know, take a bath?
This is my bath.
Yeah.
Well, if you were interested in donating to the Kickstarter campaign, it is now closed. 476 backers pledged $19,481 to bring the product to life. The shipments are scheduled for February 2018. So only 2 months out of that, people will try it. They will also have another reach goal is to get, it's now they want to make a rum-based one, which they don't have before. So to add to the whiskey, the rum. I feel like the rum would be a little harder with the amount of sugar that's in there. Might leave your armpits a little sticky and sensitive to bumblebees and and dragonflies. I don't know what else drinks that type of stuff. But I was going to order some for you and also maybe one to give away, but now we're just going to have to wait to see where it ends up selling on a regular basis afterwards.
That's kind of exciting. I mean, I'm excited. I definitely would try it. And who knows? By next year, I'll probably be giving it out as gifts.
How would somebody take that if you're giving out a deodorant to them?
Well, a white elephant gift, maybe?
I think I could go with the white elephant gift. I'm now bouncing to the website because they say that you could order some. Okay, so for a little more, I can't get you the 1 ounce single shot, but I can get you a triple shot for $12. So it would be breaking the bank. And ooh, maybe we should order two.
Yeah, there's whiskey vanilla and whiskey lavender and whiskey, whiskey black pepper.
Ooh. If you want your wife to smell like a steak.
Whatever gets you in the mood. Well, I think that's pretty cool. That's really cool.
So all the 1 ounce ones are sold out, so we're going to have to try the regular ones.
Yeah. Okay. No. Well, that's like 6 month supply, right? Because it's supposed to last you 3 months?
No, the 3.4 lasts 3 months. The 1 ounce lasted 1 month.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so if you buy two bottles, 6 months.
And maybe somebody will want it as a random gift. Start giving it out for birthday presents. They'll probably take that worse than our worst
like
suggestion.
Guys would just be like, hey, this is pretty cool. Women, on the other hand, unless they're, you know, they love whiskey or just, they love drinking, but not to say not everybody loves drinking, but, I think it would still be pretty cool. It'd be different.
Well, let's get into some Houston articles, as that was part of the goal since it's a Houston episode, to really focus on things that are happening here and especially over the next few weeks. There are still many options available. You could actually have dinner and bring in the new year with Jim Crane and the World Series trophy for $120 a plate.
Wow.
And Jim Crane will let you take a picture with the World Series trophy if you put up the $120 a plate. So that being said, do you mind waiting outside while I go and get me a picture with the World Series trophy?
I don't mind.
I'm kidding. I wouldn't do that. I'd dine and dash way before that. But if you're interested, you could sign up. They still had plates available as of this afternoon when I called them. So if that's your thing, I would go for it. The pictures that they have with the trophy look so much different than like the newspaper one. It just looks all shiny, like they put some extra sheen on it or polished up the chrome for this picture. But for $120, I'd want to touch it too, like hug it like my own child, maybe wrap it in a blanket. Where? That ain't no baby.
So just like a picture, like a professional picture, or like from your cell phone, or
Well, I'm sure it's with your cell phone, but I like where your head's at. Like maybe a LinkedIn professional picture, like myself in the foreground, the trophy in the back, or the trophy in the foreground and myself in the back. And they're like, well, we really couldn't see your picture. I know, because I'm a champion. A World Series champion? No, not at all. This is just representative of my personality and the winning ideas I'm going to bring to your organization.
Hey, it'd be one of those bucket lists check off.
So what'd you do for the new year? I had dinner with the World Series trophy and a side of escargot.
Hey.
We'll see. Well, other things that are happening in Houston. If you've ever wanted to invest in a brewery.
And speaking of the beer, by the way, the folks at Buffalo Bayou Brewery say they are offering, they're trying to give away free beer for life.
Yeah, all they're asking is that you help them raise money for their new $14 million tap room. A live look over where it will be built. This is in the First Ward area of our city. If you contribute $1,000, you get free beer for life. That is in addition to a custom tankard and your nameplate engraved on the contributor wall. So there you have it.
One beer per day until the end of your days. And you can come into our tap room. We'll have a little qualifier there for you, and you can come in and enjoy anything that we have on our tap wall.
Well, the brewery plans to open up their new tap room at the end of next year.
Are you going to do that?
We live nowhere close to it.
Yeah, but you would have your name engraved into a wall, and you get free beer for life.
But it, like reading it more, it's more like one beer a day. So if you don't live relatively close to it,
yeah,
like it'd be one thing if they said for 7 days, you can come at the end of the 7 days and fill up your growler because you didn't get your beer a day. So if it was one growler a week, okay, I'd probably do that because I can make my route at work to stop by Buffalo, be like, it's a Thursday, it's time to fill up the growler and then make it home with whatever brew I wanted. But okay, as it's set up for one beer, I think you have to be somebody who lives relatively close to it, within 1 or 2 miles, to really get the benefits of that.
I didn't think of it like that. So,
like, if it was something close in spring, I would definitely try it. But I'd encourage everybody else to do it. I remember your stepfather mentioning this, that there was a Minnesota brewery that did the same thing for a fundraiser, and he really thought about it. But that was his thing as well, is the distance. I'm not going to go there every day.
Correct.
So I'm never, so I'll get my $1,000 back, but it might take 2 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if that's a good investment, as you're not going to gain money off of it. If I could bequeath this to my son, be like, when I die, the Buffalo Bayou one beer a day is yours, son.
Yeah. But, yeah, I understand. If we lived really close to it and had property over there, then, yeah, that would make sense.
Maybe I could call him and get clarification. If I could fill up the growler, it might be worth it. But I can't see them willing to do that.
No, I don't see that.
But they're going to call it the Buff Brew Tap Room LLC, and it's a new business that operates 2 bars on site, a full-service kitchen, as well as a VIP room, an event space for group reservations, larger gatherings at the new location. It looks really nice in the renderings.
Yeah, I like that. That's really nice.
It's going to be located in Sawyer Yards. The location will allow Buff Brew the space to make beer and host guests in a beautifully, thoughtfully designed home, standing 3 stories tall with over 28,000 square feet. The brewery will welcome a steady flow of beer enthusiasts 7 days a week. The cornerstone of this experience will be the state-of-the-art Buff Brew Tap Room with over 40 beers on tap and a full-service kitchen. You can find more information at Next Seed USA, which is where they invested. Right now, it looks like they currently have $551,000 investment through this website. The maximum they could raise through it is $1 million. So they're well on their way for this goal. And yeah, if they were closer, I'd probably do it, because that could be a pretty cool idea. And like you said, just to have it. But I'm not sure if that's what Chris wants for his college education is. I got you this. If you go to school near the Buffalo tap room, so I need you to go to Rice.
No.
Your options are Rice or Rice.
He does like rice, though.
He does like rice. He's like going to be really disappointed when he figures out he can't eat that. Well, and another, the historic St. Arnold's Brewery, they have come out with a couple of new brews this year, and they have some stories to go with it. Most of these I have not tried yet. They have Bread Pudding St. Arnold's beer. It's cut with bread pudding and the new limited release beer from them. So that looks pretty good. They also have new in December. The bread pudding replaces Sailing Santa as the winter seasonal this year. It's a stout, and that's the latest in the quarterly Icon series. Icon Blue is a chocolate milk stout inspired by Mexican hot chocolate from one of the city's preeminent chefs, Hugo Ortega of Hugo's Charcoal and more recently Zochi fame. We make it like my grandmother used to. My grandmother never made us alcohol. That looks good. So they have bread pudding, the Icon Blue. I think I've seen this one before. It's the one that just has the Icon series. It's a different color. What else do we have here? Oh, they're just all pictures of Icon and bread pudding. So I guess those are the two that we have to try. Anything to add on that one?
Oh, no. That sounds exciting. Like, Bread pudding.
Hopefully we can get some of these at the new tap room that they just opened in spring.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's called the Thistle Draft Shop. This has been being built no less than a year. I've seen it being built because there's an agency close to it. Mary Thorne has opened Thistle Draft Shop, a craft beer and retail shop for take-home beer at 5210 FM 2920 near Gosling and Spring. Thorne, a former St. Arnold's Brewing Company employee, will offer 60 beers on tap along with the restaurant. The chef will be Ernesto Varial, who previously worked downtown at the Grove. They'll prepare burgers and other fares. Plans call for adding patio space in the front in spring. The regular hours are 11 a.m. to midnight. Alicia Stain of Century 21 represented Thistle Draft Shop in the 5,000 square foot lease. Terramont Realty represented the landlord. And so, have you seen this one when you've driven by there? This is by that one daycare, that Christopher, that we were looking at for him on 2920, the Goodard School.
I think I've missed it. But yeah, no, that sounds really exciting. Like, we definitely need to go.
Makes me want to try it, at least.
Yes.
And maybe they'll have the icon or the bread pudding there.
I mean, 60, that's a lot.
60 beers. Yeah, that might be more than Crickets, or it feels like more than Crickets in Lubbock. But I don't know. College really messes with your perception of what a count is. And so for Houston Food Awards for the year, Houston TheEater.com has posted their 2017 Eater Award winners. This is a week of voting. It's open to the people. And they have announced it for this entire year. I think the voting closed at the end of November. So the restaurant of the year is 1/5. It's owned by the chef Chris Shepherd, a steakhouse that's packed solid every night of the week, then shuts down and tries something entirely different. The goal of opening 5 different restaurants in the same building over a span of 5 years. Shepherd's first 2 iterations of 1/5, Steak and Romance Languages, have been equal parts ambitious and exciting. Next year, Shepherd will take on Fish when the Romance Language bows out in July, and at this point, it's a pretty much guaranteed that this ever ambitious chef is going to try to keep making 1/5 better. That's a pretty interesting concept, that it doesn't stay what it is.
Yeah.
That I've heard of menu changes. I've never heard of complete direction changes, but with the same chef coming up with the concepts.
Cool.
Hopefully they're added to Houston Restaurant Week next year. That's one that we have to add to it. Even though the name kind of throws me off, because I keep thinking of like 3/5 and like slavery, but 1/5. Okay. I'm okay with 1/5, especially with getting an understanding that he has 5 iterations that he just wants to rotate.
That's
it's like a
cool.
Really classy gastro pub is what it sounds like.
That sounds really cool. Man, to just be able to just shut down and have this creativity and drive, really, to do all that every week, right?
Oh, I think it's once a year.
Oh, once a year.
Yes.
Okay.
And so the first one was Steak, then it was Romance Languages, next will be Fish.
But still, I mean, to be able to prepare for that and say, this is going to be the menu, and for them to stand out.
I wonder how often the interior changes, because I'm not sure. The interior with the picture we have, it doesn't exactly represent a steakhouse from what we think of conceptually in Texas, a steakhouse.
Yeah, they have these drapes that are on the ceiling, and it makes this little
wave. It looks like something
wave
that I would more see in an Indian restaurant or
yeah.
or any Asian fusion restaurant,
yes.
Except the colors are a lot damper.
Yeah, the colors are a lot like browns and it looks like grays and tans.
So, but, and I wondered, was the romance language, do they have pinks and whites, or was it the same look? I'm interested. Now I'm in. I'll at least try this once and go out with family. Hopefully it's under $70 a plate.
We'll see.
The chef of the year announced by Eater.com is Hugo Ortega, who was just mentioned in our last story of having the special brew with St. Arnold's. The Icon Blue was blended after Hugo. It's been a banner year for Hugo Ortega. In addition to opening Zoshi, his much-lauded restaurant that landed Eater critic Bill Adson list of the country's best new restaurants, Ortega also took home the 2012 James Beard Award for the best chef in the Southwest.
Wow.
Next year, his empire is scheduled to only get bigger. While he runs his restaurants in Houston and Azocha, the chef is plotting expansion to Los Angeles alongside Chef Michael Mina, and really it couldn't have happened to a better person. Everything we're hearing about Ortega, he sounds amazing.
I know.
I want to try it. He has a beer named after him with one of the most historic or recognized Houston beer brands. He's opened up a restaurant and winning the Chef Critics of the Month. He has restaurants in Mexico and the U.S. I feel like he's leaving Canada out. He could be a one-man NAFTA.
Hey.
Okay. All right. The most stunning restaurant of the year is Ponente. Astros owner Jim Crane bought a real beauty when he opened Ponente. Helmed by chef Danny Trace, the restaurant's interior is bright and elegant without being pretentious, offering a cozy vibe that is still totally sophisticated, both a date night destination and a solid option for dining with out-of-town parents. Ponente is a gorgeous new addition to the city's dining scene. This is also the one I was referencing that's going to have the World Series trophy for New Year's Eve. And you could gain for $120.
It's pretty.
It seems like something out of, what's that movie? The most recent iteration was with, I'm pretty sure it was Leonardo DiCaprio, about the Roaring Twenties. Not Grapes of Wrath, even though that has Leonardo DiCaprio. Oh, what is the name of it? I'm going to have to look it up. The Great Gatsby. Okay. That's what it reminds me of, with the gold and the structures and how it looks super modern, but it kind of looks like it's older because it's a lot of square shapes.
I figured those are the, like, they have these, I guess, chandeliers, right?
Yeah, I'd consider those chandeliers.
I figured you'd want one of those in our house.
Chandeliers are always a great option. I think we could put one in here without a problem.
It looks really cool, though.
Bar of the Year, this one I've heard a lot about. Better Luck Tomorrow. Bar impresario Bobby Hugel and James Beard award-winning chef Justin Yu makes a seriously killer duo. Their new Heights Bar has already become a fixture in the neighborhood thanks to a 1-2 punch of expertly mixed, thoughtfully considered cocktails and interesting, innovative bar food. The party melt is rapidly becoming a Houston classic. The friendly crowd of locals and regulars also play a huge role in what makes Better Luck Tomorrow such a good place.
We should go there.
This is one of the only ones in this whole Eater, Houston choosing for 2017. Mm-hmm. That was the readers' picks and then the critics' choice as well as the best bar. It was unanimous as Better Luck Tomorrow. My really only interaction with that Heights area is 8th Row Flint, just for their whiskey selection. Mm-hmm. But I think I could branch out. This looks Austin as Austin gets.
Mm-hmm.
With the name like it too, but those are the best names of bars where you're like, where'd you get that? Whatever, I'm showing up anyways. Alright. Fast Casual Restaurant of the Year, Pele Pele Kitchen. And so this is different than Pele Pele, the regular menu that we traditionally go out to that has South American with, like, the kebabs that are hanging from it.
You mean that really fancy restaurant?
Yes, but this is kitchen, so it's a little, it's...
Low-key?
Yeah. I would say lower-key are not quite built in the image of the original Pele Pele. While mm-hmm. it's still South American, it's just not as sit-down or formal of a dining experience.
But still, it has very... It's very colorful. The chairs and the artwork.
It's amazing to think. When I used to be a server in Houston, and this is when I was like 17 to, I think, 19, is when I was in the food industry. I worked at a place off of 1960 and Veterans Memorial. Italian food would be a bit of an exaggeration of what we made. It was right there at Olive Garden level, so it wasn't anything prestigious, it wasn't Carrabba's, but it was a great experience. I still like the people I worked with there. One of the things you met so many people, person we came across was also a pizza owner in Spring of Paul's Pizza Place that's right near Klein High School. So it's amazing to see that he's gone from opening a pizza restaurant to making the South American cuisine restaurants. Particularly this, for example, that Pele Pele is really formal, really good food, and it's all South American style. So if you're looking for mashed potatoes, it's going to be more sweet potatoes with the mash and the flavors and the spices that come from South America. This, I imagine, is the same thing. The one thing that's always weird... So, story of the hero of the year goes to Houston, Texas, the city. In the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, every single Houstonian showed exactly what makes the special, the city special. Chefs, sommeliers, publicists, volunteers of all kinds involved in Space City restaurant industry quickly sprung into action, feeding tens of thousands meals of the storm. Which is one thing I must say, is this is the first time I've ever seen a natural disaster where people have to start turning away clothes and food, saying, we have enough.
Yes. Yes. It was, if you were here during the storm, I mean, it was pretty awesome to witness and see. And even if you were there to help out, I mean, it's pretty amazing that with the amount of people here, there was so much good of everybody wanting to help everybody. So,
yeah. You could read more about this article by going directly to the website, houston.eater.com, and it'll be the best, the article title, if you're searching in Google, will be the Eater 2017 Awards. So please go and check that out. And so, speaking of Houston restaurants, one thing that I didn't realize until today, when I was looking up these articles, is Houston Press put together an article, and I would like to say a moment of silence for Houston Press, as they're getting rid of their print team, as that industry is just dying, so they have laid off a lot of their staff this year. This article was written back in April 18th prior to them shuttering, but Houston Press is iconic to Houston. Similar to what the Houston Post was, the Houston Press filled that void when the Chronicle won that award, and they just went for a more different approach in looking for Houston. It's sad that a city of this size, too, entertainment companies couldn't survive. So they didn't just shutter their doors. They were sold off first to get the rights to a lot of their distribution network. But this article was written by Thomas Nguyen. Why isn't there already a Michelin-starred restaurant in Houston? And one of the things, if you're unfamiliar to it, the Michelin is... Art Michelin, it's told by the article, was founded by Michelin, the French tire manufacturer, in 1900. The first guide was published and given to motorists and cyclists for free. The purpose was to provide them with helpful information about the service locations, route, and where they could eat, sleep along the way. Because places to eat were listed, the guide eventually led to the need to discern what type of food was served, whether the food was good, and the details of the restaurant. The brothers believed that the guide, the original content marketing idea, would help promote and encourage more travel, which would have a direct impact on the 12-year-old tire business at the time. The selection of the restaurants and a guide offer the best restaurants in each category, and inclusion is an honor in itself and defines the establishment among the best of the best. In New York, there are 900 restaurants that have been reviewed by the Michelin inspectors. Only 76 of them received a designation of 1, 2, or 3 stars. Additionally, the Bib Gourmand distinction is used to identify restaurants that have good value for money, and some are the inspector's personal favorites. The stars have had the same standard of designation for nearly 100 years. The information and criteria required for the classification and awards are revised and updated every year. According to the Michelin Guide, the ratings are defined as follows. 1 star, high quality cooking, worth a stop. 2 stars, excellent cuisine, worth a detour. 3 stars, exceptional cuisine, worth a special journey. And Bib Gourmand, inspector's favorite for a good value. A diner can expect to find 2 courses, a glass of wine, or dessert for $40 or less. That's like Applebee's prices. According to Ellis, Michelin does not publish how many inspectors it employs, but each inspector dines and reviews approximately 250 restaurants a year.
Wow.
Stars are awarded to the restaurants themselves, not the chefs. But if a chef leaves and goes to another restaurant, the restaurant does not immediately become Michelin starred. What we see, however, is the title of Michelin starred chef follow a chef to new ventures. Though this is an important note. So what makes the guide and the rating system unique? Anonymity, consistency seems to be the key. Because the reviews are compiled from culinary and hospitality experts who have been in the industry for 10 years at least, and their identity is entirely anonymous. The Michelin Guide is exceptionally unique. The anonymity allows for inspectors to dine just as any guest would, thus receive the same treatment. Our inspectors make visits to restaurants to gauge the quality of cuisine. And so, why doesn't Houston have an award right now? I don't know. Houston's has had its share of James Beard winners, who's one of the lead diners, in the past couple of years. So could Houston be the next city added to the guide? They indicate they're noncommittal. They're always keeping an eye on the hot dining scene. We have nothing to announce at this time, but there are chefs doing incredibly things all across Texas. So though there's none that are technically rated, there's a couple they recommend. One is Yatasha, which was based in Soho, London, and was awarded the Michelin star. They have one in Houston. Scallop Shumi, prawn and crispy bean curd should be tried, as well as a venison puff. Didn't expect deer to be on that menu with the other seafood fairing orders. So is this something that you consider when you're traveling, or have you ever traveled with somebody that looks at the Michelin ratings when they're going to a new city?
Honestly, I didn't even know there was a Michelin rating. This is the first I've ever heard of it. I mean, I didn't know, but it's really cool now. I mean, I would probably start looking around to say, hey, new city, new place. Let's see if they have any Michelin ratings, and hopefully it's within my budget. But I think that's really cool. I didn't know anything about it. I mean, especially, you know, when I think of Michelin, I just think of tires. That's it.
And their food rating is the most prestigious.
And that it is, which is amazing to me, because I didn't, like I said, I had no clue that they were even part of that. Like, I just think of Anthony Bourdain.
No, you're right. So they were like an original Anthony Bourdain. We're like Howard Johnson.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Howard
but
Johnson.
That's amazing. 250 reviews or that they go a year. I mean, that's a lot.
Well, each reviewer does 250.
Yeah, each reviewer, but you don't know how many reviewers are out there.
So that means almost every day they're eating out.
Exactly. Man, that's insane.
I wonder, do they have a quota since they don't explain much about it? Or they're like, you can only name two Michelin places this year out of the 250. And sometimes they get down to the end of the year and they're like, I can't decide a favorite. So I left them both off, or those are the two I select to go on.
Huh. But I presume that the people that are doing these reviews are probably pretty known chefs. I mean, that's just, I mean, if it's that prestigious, I would think that it would be chefs that would be going out, or food taster people. I don't know what they call them.
No, you're right. It does sound a bit like Fight Club.
Yeah, like, you got a black card or whatever. Like, I feel like they're just 007.
Like, do two of them ever show up at the same restaurant, and do they know? Is there like a special ring that they wear from like James Bond in the in the Spectre crowd?
I want them to have like a special handshake or like a glance, like a coded.
It's like, oh.
Or phrases.
Or they walk in, they're like, I see you're riding on the Michelin's 4200s. Are you one of us?
Yeah. Or do they just like, I don't know, click in, or maybe there's an app or something.
It's like Foursquare, but just for restaurant reviewers.
Hey, you never know. You never
know. Quick, come in this way. Well, in our last article for the day, this is from the Houstonia, which it's HoustoniaMag.com. This is a new one that I heard, so now it is saved. There's a lot of delivery options that are available now. It's no longer just pizza or Chinese food that you have your options with. So between Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber Eats, what would you say are your top two most ordered foods that you think Houstonians generally order through it?
Pizza. And maybe burgers.
Pizza and burgers. Okay. I considered chicken and burgers. Maybe they're one and the same. Maybe they're separate. Would it surprise you? This article coming from the Houstonia, once again, written by Corey Garcia. It's amazing what you can get delivered. Data analysis by Grubhub makes a pretty good idea about what Houstonians want delivered. It probably won't surprise you to find out that the answer is meat. So, you're correct. Burgers could definitely be a link there. Mm-hmm. Up at the top of the list are a whole bunch of chicken dishes. Chicken tacos, chicken fajitas, chicken flautas, chicken fried steak, and the ever-reliable beef fajitas. In fact, Houston orders beef fajitas more than any other city in the country, making us way cooler than the burger-obsessed Dallas. Sweet potato, tot-loving Philadelphia or Las Vegas, who ordered more tuna sandwiches than anywhere else in the country.
Wow. That's random. Tuna?
Yeah. There has to be a study in that. If I was in food sciences, I would do my dissertation on why does Las Vegas eat so much tuna? Being in the desert, too, at that. Maybe they just miss fish.
Maybe.
I guess we have to try tuna for Christopher. That's the only thing he hasn't tried is canned tuna.
Yeah, he hasn't.
So we have to see if he would go for that. But nationwide, the big winner here was poke. You know what poke is? P-O-K-E?
I thought it was like a bowl of, well, a bowl.
Yeah, and so it's a dish. It's a bowl with stuff in it. It looks like it's potato-based. But just has the different flavors. But Houston, it seems, was not the only city to experience a poke boom in 2017, with the dish seeing a 600%+ increase in orders coast to coast. Those numbers make it a runaway winner this year, with the closest competition of soft pretzels seeing a 221% increase. I didn't think any of these companies would let you just order a pretzel. Because if it's like 20 minutes late, it's no longer going to be soft by the time it gets to your house.
Like, are you talking about the big pretzels?
I assume if they're meaning soft pretzels. Who makes a small soft pretzel?
I
think of the ones in the mall. What's from that company? It's like blue. Isn't it blue?
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming. It's the ones that you see in the mall. The yellow and blue company.
Yeah.
But America's most divisive food other than pineapple pizza?
Ooh.
Comes in at number three as avocado toast.
What?
So the millennials, that's why they don't own houses. Raise your cheer as you like. The biggest surprise and the dish I'm most happy to see on the list are mini corn dogs popping up at number 10.
Oh, really? Mini corn dogs.
Which means most of these people are just using it for their kids.
Ah, yeah.
It's just like, I'm working, sense. Be quiet, there's some mini corn dogs coming. Please don't open the door and go out without me.
Daycare, who knows?
True. But now if you're wondering if 2018 has in store, the whole home delivery Grubhub is ready to make some predictions. They're still high on poke, but they think the dish that's in the driver's seat right now is lettuce chicken wraps, which are already doing booming business in Detroit. Other dishes to keep an eye on are bulgogi bibimbap, a roasted cauliflower and pumpkin soup. But there's a dark horse dish that might come out of nowhere, spaghetti squash. Believe it or not, it's the trendiest dish in the nation right now, but this is still Houston, so if you want to make a name for yourself in the city, it's probably good to make some friends with local meat.
Ah.
So, I have to try some of this...
Poke?
Poke?
Well, so, I mean, I've had poke, but it was like Japanese... In relation to Japanese, so it had like meat or noodles or, you know, vegetables in it. But it was just basically a bowl, whether it was pasta or rice, and just a bunch of other ingredients in it. It kind of reminded me of having sushi, but it was in a bowl and it wasn't wrapped in seaweed.
Well, that's what this picture looks like. It looks like uncooked fish with avocado and corn and rice in it. Mm-hmm. So exactly like you said, it's closer to sushi than anything else.
But yeah, it's like just having a big bowl of sushi, except for it's not in little small.
So do you, is this only made at Japanese restaurants, or is this...
It was just, there was a... And unfortunately, I can't remember, but I think it had the word poke in it as far as the restaurant in Houston. And, but yeah, it was, I guess, Japanese-like. So it had, like, drinks and other things that you can get with it, so.
Well, the origin of poke is actually not Japanese.
Oh. Really?
It's a Hawaiian cuisine, and it's technically a raw fish salad served as an appetizer, and sometimes as a main course. Traditional forms are aku and oily tuna, or he, which is octopus. Octopus poke is usually called by its Japanese name, taka.
Ah.
And so, maybe it is Japanese, except in places like the island of Niha, where the Hawaiian language is spoken. Increasingly popular is ahi poke, generally made with yellowfin tuna. Adaptations may feature raw salmon, various shellfish as the main ingredient. You know what this reminds me of? What is that Mexican dish where it's usually like a white fish or a shrimp, but they make it with a lot of lime? And so it's an appetizer, but the lime, the acidity actually cooks the dish, so the fish isn't quite raw. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't. I didn't think you ate fish.
Well, when I go out with clients, like, I kind of have to try stuff, and they're like, I want to order
that's
this appetizer.
I would have eaten, but I'm like, wait. That doesn't sound like something you would eat at all.
Well, it's more of like a Yucatan dish, and I'm still...
Oh, man, that makes me want to try it. Like...
Ceviche.
Oh, ceviche. Okay. No, I don't think I've ever had ceviche.
And so that... But that's what ceviche is. It's based... The raw just means it's not cooked or not heated. However, the fish is marinated for about 18 to 24 hours.
Wow.
And plenty of lime juice. That means all the potential bacteria is killed. This is actually why you could eat ceviche in countries that don't have our Western sanitation policies. They provide that they didn't add tap water to the ceviche. The dish is always 100% safe to have in Mexico. And so, you marinate the fish in the lime juice for a minimum of 18 hours, preferably 24 or 36 hours. The standard is 24. You could use salmon or tuna, though the standard firm white fish, just like Peru and Mexico. So ceviche, I guess, would be another example of this, except it's never served in a huge bowl. It's definitely an appetizer where you use, like, there's little teaspoons to put it on a crumpet.
No. The restaurant I went to, it was like a good, probably a large-sized bowl, and they just dumped the ingredients in there. So, it tasted really good. But it makes sense that, you know, there's Hawaiian and a hint of Japanese in there. I know a lot of Japanese people take vacations to Hawaii. That's one thing I did notice when I went to Japan, and we had a stop in Hawaii for 8 hours, and yeah, it was like totally different than what they wore, and it's like, oh, go to Hawaii. That's where all the Japanese wear Hawaiian shirts. Oh, okay.
Everyone loves a good Hawaiian shirt to wear when you're not
flip-flops
at work.
Flip-flops came out. Not that they don't, like, they wear, it's just American style sandals. It just came out of nowhere because it was very conservative, I think, when we went to Japan. You get the shoes and, you know, but then once you get on the plane, it's like, swap, let's change out of all this.
I understand. And so, well, I think that's all the stories, unless you had something that you wanted to add.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year's to all, and to all a good night. Yeah. Hopefully our son.
What?
I don't hear him.
I don't hear him either.
Okay. Hopefully he's not hiding behind the door again. Just waiting to get us. Well, thank you for joining Free Drinks Next Week. We'll be back next week with a full-length episode with the rest of Free Drinks Next Week. You can find our show online on Spotify, iTunes, and personally, I use the player called RSS Feed, which is helpful and doesn't take up much memory on your phone. Please leave a message on iTunes or leave a rating. If it's a 5 or plus, we'll read it on the air. And you can always email us for questions or suggestions, anything that you would like. Thanks for your time.
Marty, find out where the police will be taking him. Send over a bottle of bubbly with a bucket of ice in a card. Have it say, tough break, get drunk on me. Use the bucket of ice down your marbles. Here's C.
Well, Mr. Callahan.